are Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government with his weekly update, including a damage report from the tornado touchdown in the northwestern region of the county yesterday, plus a road closure update. As climate change drives stronger storms and rising risks, New Yorkers are stepping up with local solutions. World leaders met in Manhattan for Climate Week this week, but communities across the state are taking their own steps to fight climate change. Annie Bennett reports on what's being done close to home. A new alliance of business and labor groups is pushing back against a plan for New York to take over Central Hudson Gas and Electric. The New York Public News Network's Jesse King has more coming up. Plus, the latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast with Tom Candela. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has addressed the UN General Assembly. Before he began to speak last hour, scores of diplomats and world leaders walked out of the room. The Israeli leader used his speech to castigate other countries that have decided to recognize a Palestinian state despite the war in Gaza. And Netanyahu blamed other countries who he says have left Israel to face its enemies alone.
Well, for many countries here, when the going got tough, you caved. And here's the shameful result of that collapse. For much of the past 2 years, Israel has had to fight a seven-front war against barbarism with many of your nations opposing us.
The Israeli army has set up loudspeakers to blare Netanyahu's speech into Gaza. Israel has also commandeered the phones of Palestinians in Gaza to broadcast the speech as well. Netanyahu used his remarks to speak to Israeli hostages, saying they are not forgotten. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the safety of mifepristone. This is a medication often used for abortion and miscarriage management. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports the review does not have any immediate effect on the availability of the drug.
In states that ban or severely restrict access to abortion, many patients have gotten around those restrictions by using telemedicine and abortion medications they receive through the mail. A group of Republican attorneys general don't like that and urged the Trump administration's FDA to tighten access to mifepristone. In a letter obtained by NPR, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry say they are re-reviewing safety evidence for the medicine and may change the prescribing rules. Professional groups representing OBGYNs have said, quote, mifepristone is an incredibly safe medication and that FDA restrictions should reflect that. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a modest uptick in inflation last month. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 340 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in August were up 2.7% from a year ago, according to the Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve. That's a slightly larger annual increase than the previous month. Consumer spending also rose in August, while the personal savings rate went down. President Trump is ordering steep new tariffs on imported pharmaceuticals, home furnishings, and heavy trucks. The import taxes, which range from 25 to 100%, are set to take effect next week. Stock in Boeing is up. Turkish Airlines has announced plans to acquire up to 225 new Boeing jets. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. President Trump is calling former FBI Director James Comey a liar, Trump wrote online this morning after Comey was indicted yesterday on two criminal counts by a federal grand jury in Virginia. This is in connection with congressional testimony Comey gave 5 years ago about the investigation of Russian interference in U.S. elections. Comey says he is innocent. The chatbot developed by Elon Musk's artificial intelligence company will now be available to federal agencies. NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports This is the latest in a series of deals the Trump administration has brokered with AI companies.
Federal workers can now use Grok, the chatbot developed by the company xAI. The cost to each federal agency for 18 months is just 42 cents, an apparent reference to the book The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in which a supercomputer says 42 is the answer to a question about life and the universe. Last month, the Trump administration announced an agreement for use of Google's Gemini tool through next year for just 47 cents per federal agency, as well as year-long deals with OpenAI and Anthropic to use their AI tools for a dollar per agency. Grok made headlines in July when the chatbot made anti-Semitic and hateful comments. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News.
Hurricane Helene hit Florida a year ago today. The Category 4 storm swept up through the Appalachians. It left substantial damage in North Carolina. The National Hurricane Center says Helene is responsible for as many as 250 deaths. That makes it the deadliest U.S. hurricane since Katrina in 2005. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, every Friday we hear from Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. Happy Friday, Dan.
Happy Friday to you.
We had a busy weather day yesterday in the county.
Yeah, my goodness gracious.
Several tornado warnings, as you may have heard or perhaps even encountered. The National Weather Service reported that there was a tornado touchdown in the county, in the hamlet of Hazel, which is in the town of Rockland. Mm-hmm. They're in Livingston Manor, Roscoe area up there. Do you have any updates about what damages are or any other reporting that you can provide listeners?
Well, the Weather Service has a team there today, I believe, taking a look at the damage to see. I had seen a photo, I think you saw it too, circulating a little bit of a possible tornado, but I'm not sure. It looks like something AI could generate.
Right.
So we are not in the county yet. We'll wait for the Weather Service to give us official confirmation. We're not saying that a tornado actually did touch down, but we're going to go with whatever the Weather Service finds from their on-the-ground survey team that they have, like I said, I believe out today. What we did know is there was a tree that fell on a house on Bear Road in Calicoon Center. No injuries there. And also up in the Beaver Kill, Lou Beach area, I believe there was some wires and trees that fell on a car. But no injuries there as well. So we got lucky because that area wasn't that long ago. I think it was, 2 years ago that a tornado came through the Roscoe area. So we weren't looking to have that happen again.
Well, and also it came, as these things do sometimes, kind of out of the blue in a way. I was looking back as this was happening, looked back to see if there was some forecast about this. And the National Weather Service had actually said there's a little risk of that, and then all of a sudden you get the right conditions, and yep, boom, that can materialize very, very quickly, as it did yesterday.
And it did, and it's also, we've had a very warm September, and that's what's required for that to happen. But typically this is where we're talking about there's a hurricane coming up the coast rather than there's a tornado bearing down on you. But thankfully at this point it seems that everyone's escaped with little damage, no injury, certainly no death. And thanks to our emergency responders and our road crews who were making sure that, I'm sure there were branches down and lines down. I know there were power outages. Monticello had a power outage yesterday.
Yeah, there was a power outage in Calicoon just ahead of this storm moving through as well yesterday. And again, thanks to all the emergency teams that are out there. And a reminder, too, that it is still hurricane season.
Yes.
And even though we're here in the Catskill Mountains, we are impacted by that as things can move up the coast or up the central part of the country. Those bands of hurricanes can affect us.
Yes. And that's why we rely, the county in particular, on JFF to be an emergency beacon, if you will, for us. You were getting the news out yesterday in addition to our other media outlets, and we appreciate that you're a partner on that.
We are here for that. So let's remind folks about some other things going on. There was a report from the controller's office that the county is free of fiscal stress. What does that actually mean?
What that means is that this is a review of 2024, not of 2025, because obviously we're not done with 2025 yet. But it looks at the fiscal situation, the financial situation of a county. We actually had the prior year gotten the best score ever, which counterintuitively is a zero, meaning that we aren't susceptible to any kind of fiscal stress. We got it this past year now. This is the second year in a row. A lower score indicating better finances. There was also an environmental stress score, which has fallen from 23.3 in 2020 to 13.3, where it's been for the past 3 years. Unlike fiscal stress, the data used to create the environmental stress score are things that are not within our control, like population changes, poverty levels, the tax base, unemployment rates, state federal aid, other items. But the fiscal stress score is mostly what's within our control. How are we handling taxpayers' money? Are we doing it appropriately? Do we have proper reserves built up? And the comptroller's office, who will not hesitate to be critical and investigate, says we are doing the best job that we possibly can do. So that's worth bragging about. But it also is worth pointing out that we're coming into probably what's going to be a very challenging 2026 budget year. So we are not sitting on our laurels and saying, oh, look at how good a job we did. We've got some serious challenges. I would guess that there is going to be proposed some sort of property tax increase for 2026. But it's what this is saying, and what taxpayers could take away, is that it's not as much as it would be otherwise. We've got reserves in place. We've got revenue sources that have been pretty strong. So we're in a much better position than a lot of other upstate counties to weather the financial storm that may be coming in 2026, which a lot of it has to do with reduced federal aid, which will mean reduced state aid, but also the increasing cost of everything and the fact that we are doing things now that we weren't doing just a few short years ago, from a public transportation service that people rely on to increasing our presence in the EMS and ambulance response world, which costs a lot of money, even though we can and probably will at some point start billing for some of that if we're using an ambulance. But there's a lot to work on, but this at least is something to say, listen, we have been preparing for this as well as we possibly can, according to the state comptroller's office, which really takes a hard look at these things.
Let's talk a little bit more about budgeting. When does the county start the budgeting process for fiscal year 26?
Well, if you ask our Office of Management and Budget, they never stop the budgeting process, but we've already begun it. In June, the word went out to commissioners and department heads to start submitting what they want and what they need for their offices. And meetings have been happening steadily with the county manager's office. I expect in somewhere around October, beginning of November, that the county manager, my boss, Josh Potosik, will be releasing the tentative or proposed county budget. He proposes it based on all these conversations and having a very deep understanding of the county's finances. But then it goes to the legislature, and they will then spend November and part of December looking at it, making tweaks, seeing what can and can't be done, what kind of additions or cuts should be made. There'll be two public hearings on it as well. And of course, there'll be a public hearing window or a public comment window where people can submit comments. And then probably around mid-December, the legislature will then take a vote to accept or reject. Or it's also possible, because it happened a few years ago, where they end up not taking a vote because they can't agree on it, in which case then it just sort of automatically goes into effect as Josh proposed it. Now, I don't anticipate that.
But with these looming federal cuts, have you heard anything from the state as you prepare your budgeting for 26?
Yes, we've heard some things from the state. For example, we've talked about this before, that the HEAP funding is going to be much less. So I don't know that we're going to make up for any of that funding in the county budget. But we had the RSVP program disappear, and we had to take over the funding for that. Now, I've heard some of that funding may be coming back. So some of this is a moving target. But yes, the state has been telling us in different ways, prepare for the worst, hope for the best.
So how do you prepare for the worst when it's a moving target like this?
Well, that's a question Josh probably could better answer than me, if he can. But I would say that it... I guess trusting the people that we have, Josh, our Commissioner of Management and Budget, Anna, she and he are really working hard to try to figure out where can we dip into reserves if we need to, but where can we also feel somewhat confident that the state and the federal government might actually stick to this. Because let's face it, there are some things from the federal government that they've gotten rid of and then brought back. There are other things, as you are well aware, that they have gotten rid of and probably aren't getting back. So some of that is just educated guesswork.
Well, and for us in our case, and we're referring to the federal funding that has gone away for public media, mm-hmm. that's gone away. So we're able to plan, even though it's a challenge. In this case, it just seems like you might have to have a couple of plans in place here mm-hmm. because you don't know.
Yep. And at this point, my understanding is the proposed budget is not going to propose any service cuts or layoffs. Of course, legislators may choose a different path than that. But we're getting closer and closer to that point where I can say, I think because of the good fiscal management and the fact that we have continued over the past few years to record record revenues from sales tax and room tax and other things of that nature, that we are in a good position to be able to at least weather it for 2026. 2027, too early to talk about, but if we have to dip deep into our reserves in 2026, mm-hmm. 2027 could be even more challenging.
On a programming note, on Monday, we're going to hear from our friends across the river, Commissioner Matthew Osterberg from Pike County will be here to talk about the state budget challenges that they're having over in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania state budget is 3 months late, yeah. and it's already impacting or starting to impact services, not only in Pike, but throughout the state, prompting the commissioners there to pass a resolution urging very, very forcefully that the state pass that budget. So we'll hear from Commissioner Osterberg live on Monday here at Radio Chatskill. We're talking to Dan Hoost here from Sullivan County Government, and we'll take a quick break and come back with more, including an update on the closure of a road in the county and for how long that's going to be, and also a reminder about that rabies clinic coming up. This is Radio Chatskill.
For world-renowned cellist Joshua Roman, long COVID caused an identity crisis.
That was probably the lowest point, with no confidence in my ability to recover. Crisis of faith about what music meant. It was a really dark time.
How he found his way back to the cello and a new sense of self. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm Brett Barry, host of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, with some exciting news. We're bringing our award-winning series to Radio Catskill. Join us every Saturday at 11 as we explore the stories, people, and ideas shaping our region. Culture, history, sustainability, literature, the arts, and more. That's Cats Cast with me, Brett Barry, Saturdays at 11, beginning October 4th on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're chatting with Mr. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. I mentioned this road closure. It's County Routes, County Road 72, also known as Ferndale Road. That is closing for a few weeks. How long and why is it closing?
Just a little section of it is, and I want to make sure, because some people have gotten confused. This is not Ferndale Loomis Road, which runs past Bosie's.
Right in the corner by
this is Ferndale Road, which actually goes off. It intersects close to Ferndale Loomis, but it serves the Ferndale Transfer Station. And if people live around here, they'll know exactly where that is. So you'll have to take a bit of a lengthy detour to get to the transfer station. operation starting October 1st and probably going for about another 5 weeks. We have an embankment there that's starting to fail, so we don't want anyone driving over that and finding themselves in the creek rather than on the road. So you'll have to take our posted detour will be Route 55 sort of down to Swan Lake and back around. There's shorter routes than that. We'll let people figure that out as they wish, but the transfer station will remain open. You'll just have to access it from a southerly direction rather than from the northerly direction.
Any other closures or traffic updates to remind folks of that are going on?
No, I think we're starting to wrap up our road work construction season, and I'll have some hopefully numbers and success stories, because like we had a huge bridge we've replaced. I think it was like a $6 million project down in Forestburg, and I think that's just about finished as well. So. But we always post on social media when we have road closures or even single lane stuff going on.
So. Yeah, the county is updating its coordinated transportation services plan. What is that plan, and how will it help out the community?
Yeah. This plan, which I believe is required by the state and the federal government, identifies needs and strategies to make public transit, or Move Sullivan service, paratransit services, which also is Office for the Aging or Transportation Department, and human services transportation programs that can be like our veterans and our shopping bus trips, to make them more available and beneficial to the community. Because even though we live in an area where most people would tell you you need a car to get around, there are people who can't afford that or who are not allowed to drive a vehicle for whatever reason, and we want to be able to get them where they need to go, especially if it's medical appointments or to get basic necessities or to get to work, as Move Sullivan does. So this plan is going to help us identify where the needs are and figure out the solutions for them. So obviously, we need the public to help us with that, because we are not all-knowing on things, contrary to popular opinion. So, and we also...
Contrary to what you told me,
Dave. Right? Yes. No, I was talking about me, not the county. Shh, why are you telling everyone? Anyway, we have a survey that is ongoing through October 20th. You could fill it out at surveymonkey.com/r/SullivanCTSP. We'll be posting this.
Okay,
don't
good,
worry.
I'm not writing
yes,
this down.
No, I know you're not writing it down. So surveymonkey.com/r/SullivanCTSP. I'm sure nobody's writing it down, but I felt I had to repeat it. You can possibly win a $25 gift card to a local grocery store of your choice, if you participate in this survey and agree to that. But what we really want is your feedback to help us identify these needs, because there are still people who tell me, like, why doesn't Move Sullivan go here or go there or do this? Well, this is the survey to say that in.
You've got another survey that's completed, though, the results of the Bicycle Pedestrian Master Plan survey. Speaking of transportation, different mm-hmm. forms of transportation, what did you learn from this survey?
This is more ones where you're on your own bike or your self-powered walking down a trail or something. So our planning division had done this, really geared towards, for example, like our ONW rail trail, but also our roadways. It was open from April 30th to September 5th. We collected 570 responses, which was much better than I thought it was going to be. Respondents, interestingly, were mostly between the ages of 35 and 74. And about three quarters of them are full-time residents of the county. So what did they tell us? Driving a private vehicle is still the primary way of getting to everyday destinations. We knew that. Most people typically walk less than 3 miles in any single trip. Boy, did I know that, too. But key motivations to do that are not just exercise. It's connecting with nature and accessing recreational opportunities. Fully three quarters of them expressed interest in using a bicycle as an alternative to driving, health and recreation being the primary motivations. We were very pleased to hear that. Key considerations to incentivize that, including safety improvements, better connections to key destinations, improved infrastructure, I think like bike paths, and more dedicated pathways for people to use. The top three areas that people felt that these improvements should happen, probably no surprise here, but Village of Liberty, Village of Monticello, Village of Wurtsboro, because our villages just lend themselves to being walkable destinations. Also, if you like to shop, there are great places as well. So our planning division thanks everyone for giving us those results. We are going to definitely be using that to make some recommendations to the legislature as to where to improve things for people to be able to walk and bike.
All right. Reminder that the Public Health Services has that free rabies clinic. We had some cases of rabies in the area this summer. Where are the details for that?
Yep. Oh, actually, it's online on our public health page and also on our Facebook page. It's going to be at the Mammocating Town Park in Bloomingburg on the 30th of September, 6 to 7:30 p.m. in the Rotary Pavilion. It is free, open to everyone who's a Sullivan County resident, but you need to bring proof of residency. Cats, dogs, ferrets, properly leashed, caged, or otherwise restrained, and you'll get either a one-year booster or a three-year shot.
And again, we're reminding folks about the sample ballots for the election, the Board of Elections getting ready for November.
I just posted the sample ballots a couple days ago. Took a long time because there are races in every single township. Yeah. So that's 15 townships, but also like Mammocating has six different wards. And then there's like the village of Woodridge within the town of Fallsburg that's having its election at the same time. But if you're in the village, you also get to vote in the town election. So all that is on there so that you can take a look, enlarge it, print it out, download it to see what you're going to be handed when you get to a polling place, either during early voting, which starts October 25th and runs through the 2nd of November, or on Election Day, November 4th. And one thing I also want to point out that I don't think I had mentioned before, due to the body and bag scanners now that we have in the Government Center lobby, we are moving early voting from the lobby upstairs to the hearing room, but that is accessible. There's an elevator in addition to stairs, and it'll be a little more private up in the hearing room where the legislature meets.
You know, the team here has been prepping for the election coverage, and you pointed out a lot of local races, a ton of them throughout our listening area. And while last year was a big national race with a lot of bells and whistles and attention, these races are the ones that are really going to impact you where you live. So these are ones you really should pay attention to this fall.
And we would like to see as
getting
much
out there and voting, because as you said, in almost every township in the county, at least, right?
There's races. I don't know that every township has contested races.
A significant amount.
But there is a very fair amount that there are contested races. And at this level, your vote matters more than any other level, in my opinion. I'd like to see as much turnout for this as we had last year. It's usually not the case, but I think your listeners are very engaged people, so I imagine I'm preaching to the choir here, but please get out and vote. We try to make it as easy and as convenient as possible.
And we're getting our voting information together and have that up and available hopefully by the end of next week. There's a lot to get through, but we're going to get it up for you. Also, we want to remind folks that the Household Hazardous Waste Collection Day is coming up Sunday. Remind folks about this day and what they can take.
We'll take a whole bunch of things off your hands, even radioactive material we could take off your heads. And people actually have this. I've heard some interesting stories. But mercury and paints and other things that might be more difficult to accept or that we might not accept other times of the year, we're doing it 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. this Sunday at the Monticello Transfer Station, which is where the old landfill was. Just again, bring proof of Sullivan County residency, and then we'll be happy to take all that stuff off your hands. The full list is available at our website, sullivanny.gov.
This is the day where you can take those things that they tell you on other days you can't bring, basically.
This is an exciting day for you, right?
Exactly. I'm going to be out of town, though.
No!
I know. To plan my life better. Just pivoting here, you're also the president of the board of the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. They have a big weekend with the Big Eddie Film Festival coming
up. Started last night.
Yes.
And it's running today as well. You will see me making popcorn and handing out candy starting tonight. Not handing it out. You have to buy it, and then I'll give it to you. But it's a lot of fun. I get to feel like I'm, you know, doing something special with the movies, you know, and stars. And we have a really interesting, eclectic mix of films for people to see, stuff for all ages. It's available, the whole schedule, at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. It will continue through Sunday.
I'm glad to see that they're putting your talents to use, Poppy.
Yes, right. Horn. Well, I eat as much as I pop.
And we're proud to be a media sponsor of the Big Eddie Film Festival.
Yes, you guys have been great with this. It's been wonderful to partner with you.
We have our own Patricia Rubio's short film, Catskill Talks, is premiering tomorrow, I believe.
I'll be there.
All right. Dan Hoos, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. Have a great weekend.
You too.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, from reusing building materials to investing in renewable energy, communities across New York are reimagining a greener future. Annie Bennett reports next.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This Week in This American Life. Okay, so you're on a subway car, and onto the car comes a guy wearing no pants. A couple stops later, somebody else gets on, also no pants. This keeps happening every few stops until the train has many, many people on it with no pants. Then somebody comes barreling through the car, selling pants. Mind games this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This week, world leaders gathered in Manhattan for New York Climate Week, tackling one of the most urgent global issues, climate change. But the fight against rising temperatures and extreme weather isn't just happening in the city. Across New York State, scientists, advocates, and policymakers are rolling out local solutions to cut emissions, protect vulnerable communities, and reimagine infrastructure for a warming world. Reporter Annie Bennett has more.
Representatives from around the world met in Manhattan for New York Climate Week. But across the state as well, groups are working to combat climate change.
I was in New York yesterday, attending a meeting with people who are in for the UN General Session from all over the world. I mean, this is a global issue. Climate change is kind of a major, I don't use the term existential that often, but this is an existential threat. Hi, Dr. Alonzo Plow. I'm Vice President, Chief Science Officer, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Princeton, New Jersey.
Dr. Plow's foundation is dedicated to public health and says that extreme weather events caused by global warming are a major community risk.
The Northeast has to worry about hurricanes that come ashore on our coast having flooding implications far inland. It's a season where we have to be very vigilant. But they're more frequent and stronger because of global warming.
What can be done right now to help decrease the damage of extreme weather events?
Making sure that stormwater drains off, the kind of protections that we can do with levees. I know some of that hard infrastructure work is going on. That's really important, particularly with the relationship between extreme weather and power outages. You need to know which of your neighbors is on a machine, oxygen-dependent, dialysis. There need to be coordinated plans that the most vulnerable amongst us get the most urgent support. Certainly all of us in emergency preparedness say you should have a kit, a plan. You should understand what your schools do when your kids are there and something happens. They'll generally have them shelter in place. So good planning between all the institutions in advance kind of helps us to respond and prepare much better.
New York is a leader in combating climate change, according to not just Dr. Plow, but many environmental advocates as well.
And so my friend and I decided to hold an in-person meeting. And we basically invited all the people that we knew in the New York area. And we had intended to just have a conversation about what was going on. And we came away from that meeting deciding to put together an action plan for New York State. And we have a vision in these draft recommendations in terms of what we want the future to look like.
That's Mikhail Haramati, who leads state-level industrial decarbonization work at the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC.
Industrial decarbonization is like the domestic manufacturing of materials that are used in buildings and infrastructure projects.
According to the NRDC, building materials hold a lot of carbon in them, like concrete. But it's a problem that's fairly easy to tackle.
What we decided to release for Climate Week is a set of recommendations for near-term actions that New York can take right away. If you want to slow the rate of heating of emissions, what we do today matters a lot more than what we do 10 or 15 years from now. So it, like any ways that we can reduce emissions immediately are going to be much more impactful. But with the materials, all of those emissions are going out before the building is even occupied. So I was like, we can do this stuff now. It is cheap or no cost, and we're not doing it. This is craziness.
She says that choosing building materials are like buying a car. It's most eco-friendly to get a used car, but if you can't do that, you should buy a hybrid. And only if those options aren't available would you buy a new normal car. In a similar vein, the NRDC recommends that New York State prioritize reusing building materials or looking for ways to reduce the carbon in new ones, such as eco-friendly options or designs that use less concrete.
Having locally available low-cost materials, I think, is kind of a little bit of like a godsend that's just been sitting in our backyard that we didn't notice. It's a very exciting time to be working on this, particularly if we're interested in rehabbing housing and being able to like have energy efficiency measures added to them, or solar or other renewable energy added to those structures that maybe weren't in good enough shape to be able to withstand them before.
But with federal cuts, it's harder and harder to get things done, and the burden is being put on local nonprofits and governments. Governor Hochul announced an onslaught of commitments that New York is making in recognition of this year's Climate Week. This clip is from a recent press conference.
Let me just give a snapshot of what we're doing here in New York. While the federal government refuses to protect us, we will continue to build a healthy and safe future for our people and our planet. And this year, I announced the Sustainable Future Program, which is the largest single climate investment in New York history. And we're committed to this. And it was bold, and it was had a big price tag, but the price tag for doing nothing is even greater, in our opinion. So this was an investment well worth making. In 2024, I signed the Climate Change Superfund Act, shifting the burden of paying for climate change mitigation off of New Yorkers to the fossil companies themselves. Of course, it's being attacked in court, but what's new? Every time we try to do something ambitious or to stop something bad, it ends up in the courts. But we're continuing our programs to help people pay their bills, and with the Inflation Reduction Act rebates, which make energy rebates more accessible. So I just want to say this. We just refuse to be derailed by this, and we just must hold firm and continue creative ways, as we've done, to protect the environment.
From Liberty, I'm Annie Bennett for Radio Catskill.
Now, a coalition of businesses and labor unions has formed to oppose legislation that would allow New York State to take over Central Hudson Gas and Electric. The New York Public News Network's Jesse King reports.
Central Hudson is a key figure behind the new Protect Our Power Coalition, which also includes the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 320, the Utility Workers Union of America, the Hudson Valley Building Construction Trades Council, and the Chambers of Commerce for Dutchess, Orange, and Ulster counties. Speaking at a launch event outside the utility's offices in Poughkeepsie Tuesday, Central Hudson President and CEO Stephanie Raymond had a simple message.
The government does not have the skill, expertise, or workforce to run this utility. Let me be very clear. We are not for sale. Yeah.
The coalition staunchly opposes the Hudson Valley Power Authority Act, which would allow New York to buy Central Hudson and turn it into a state-owned utility called the Hudson Valley Power Authority. Central Hudson has drawn criticism from customers and lawmakers alike in recent years for its repeated rate hikes and its botched rollout of a new billing system in 2021. Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha and State Senator Michelle Hinchey, both Democrats, introduced the bill to take over Central Hudson last year. Shrestha says she's heard that Central Hudson has a right to make a profit during its rate cases with the New York Public Service Commission, so she wants to remove the profit motive from the equation.
We do not believe there is a solution unless we remove the investor owners that have a right to this profit and that create all these perverse incentives to overinvest in unnecessarily capital-intensive projects, because that's what jacks up their authorized profits.
Hudson Valley for Public Power, another coalition that supports the bill, says taking over Central Hudson would result in lower bills for customers. The Protect Our Power Coalition rejects that idea. It argues utility costs are skyrocketing in part because of sluggish efforts by the state to ramp up energy generation. And it says the sheer cost of buying Central Hudson would likely fall on its customers. Heather Bell-Meyer is the president and CEO of the Orange County Chamber of Commerce.
There is no evidence that a government takeover of Central Hudson will lower energy costs. Asking Hudson Valley residents and businesses to trust that the government can take over a utility and operate it more efficiently or reduce rates is just not believable.
Some of those at Tuesday's rally went as far to say that language about lowering bills was removed from the act. Klaus Yoder, a volunteer with Hudson Valley for Public Power, refutes that.
Nothing in the bill has changed when it comes to lowering rates and keeping them as low as possible at any given time. That is the whole point, and that is what scares this profit-driven utility.
According to its website, Hudson Valley for Public Power estimates buying Central Hudson would cost anywhere from $518 million to roughly $1.2 billion. It says the purchase would be financed up front with tax-exempt authority bonds issued by the new Hudson Valley Power Authority. That debt would be repaid through customers' bills, but it argues it wouldn't jack up prices because the bonds wouldn't involve high interest rates or taxes. Hudson Valley for Public Power estimates the takeover would result in a net savings of $45 million. The group says it's conducting a study to examine that. The Protect Our Power Coalition also notes that taking over Central Hudson would wipe out more than $60 million a year in property tax revenue for local governments and schools across the region. It also questions who would be in charge of the new authority, whether jobs would be lost, and whether the reliability of the power grid could be jeopardized. Todd DiOrio is the president of the Hudson Valley Building Construction Trades Council.
Now here's the truth about labor powers in the region.
And cut off that segment. Unfortunately, we'll get the full segment up on the website. That was the New York Public News Network's Jesse King reporting. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got the latest episode of Curtain Call. And Tom Caldella has some highlights of local theater, too. This is Radio Chatsko.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, reminding you to join me and my friends for Laura Flanders and Friends on Radio Catskill Monday evenings at 7, followed by Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. And then, starting October 6th, we welcome the Janice Adams Show to its new night at 8, followed by La Voz en Breve with Mariel Fiore. Four powerhouse shows back-to-back, local voices bringing world-class conversations about what's really happening in our lives. Monday evenings on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, every Friday, the newest episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call, drops, and Tom Caldella is here with a preview of that. But Tom, before we get to that, we want to mention a couple of theater highlights happening this weekend, including Scranton Fringe. We had on the executive director of Scranton Fringe earlier in the week to talk about all the great events there. One of them is Decompositions.
Correct.
From Tanis Kowalczyk over there at
Farm Arts. Tanis Kowalczyk, Farm Arts Collective over in Pennsylvania. So she's making her way. She's got a traveling show. Actually, she just came back from recently from, I believe it was Serbia, where she performed Decompositions. And so she'd be performing this weekend, starting tonight at the Scranton Fringe. And I believe it's at the Marywood College in Scranton, Pennsylvania. But you could look that up on their on the website. But they're performing Decompositions, and I am going. I have tickets to tonight's performance. The roving thespian will make his way out there.
It is, in fact, at Regina Hall at the Marywood campus in Scranton tonight at 8, Saturday at 4, and Sunday at 4.
That's right.
Also in the community this weekend, River Rep Junior.
That's right.
Their fall workshop for children.
Their fall workshop, that kicks off this weekend. This weekend, Saturday the 27th, is their very first get together, if you will. And this is a workshop for young people up to 18 years old and to learn about the theater arts from professional theater makers.
That's open to students 8 to 18. Classes are at the Delaware Valley Opera Center in Lake Huntington, New York. And more information at riverrep.org.
Yes,
all right, so what
exciting.
Do we have for the latest episode of Curtain Call?
Yes, thank
the theater
you.
Podcast.
So this week, I welcome Elizabeth Marvel. Now, many of our listeners may remember her from productions like House of Cards, Homeland, and these are big, you know, big series.
Big TV shows.
Big
yeah.
TV shows. She was also in Netflix's The Unbelievable, amongst many other Broadway shows, King Lear and things like that, Broadway and everything else. So she's very, very well known in the theater community and in film and television, along with the director Mark Wing Davey. His career spans stage, screen, and even The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He played a big role in that. And I'm not going to say it because I can't pronounce it right. I mess it up every time, even though he corrected me several times. And we're going to talk about their new off-Broadway production of And Then We Were No More. It is a play written by Tim Blake Nelson. New York Times has just listed it among the 13 new off-Broadway plays you must see this fall. So it's a big show that's coming up, and it's going to be produced and shown down at Soho Theater down in Manhattan.
And Tim Blake Nelson, he's one of those actors.
I'm sorry, at La Mama.
Oh,
yes, La Mama, yes.
Tim Blake Nelson's one of those actors that he's one of those character actors that you just know when you see him.
That's right.
One of his featured roles was in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Mm-hmm. And he's just a great actor. So anyway, he's done that play, and you're talking to the actors in it. This is the
talking
latest.
Talking to Elizabeth Marvel and the director, Mark Wing Davey.
It's the latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast. This is just a preview. You can hear the full episode.
At La Mama.
And you can hear the full episode, though, at WJFFradio.org. Hey, thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Joining me are two extraordinary guests. First is Elizabeth Marvel, one of the most versatile and fearless actors working today. Her theater work has earned her multiple Obie Awards, as well as a Drama Desk, Drama League, and a Lucia Lortel Award nominations. Alongside her is director Mark Wing Davey, whose adventurous career spans acting and decades of boundary producing directing as well. He also led NYU's graduate acting program from 2008 to 2020, shaping the next generation of theater artists. Elizabeth, Mark, I want to welcome both of you to Curtain Call.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me and making me feel far fancier than I am.
So I want to talk a little bit about the show itself. It's billed as a provocative new play about justice, mercy, and the limits of humanity in a fractured world. Can you give us a little bit about what that means and what this play is about?
Yeah, I think. So it's a play which is set in a kind of near future, mm-hmm. a kind of utopian future, if you look at it one way, or a dystopian future, if you look at it in another. And it really is the story of a lawyer, played by Elizabeth, and her coming up against the system or working with the system on a particular trial. So it's like a kind of courtroom drama in that sense. So it's very gnarly, engaged with issues. It's quite very linguistically rich, and it concerns a case which she then has to argue in this society. Okay. And it's a passionate play, but it's passionate both with emotion and with ideas which are very, very precisely expressed. Tim is a wonderful writer of that kind of work.
Okay. We talk about Tim Blake Nelson, of course.
Tim Blake Nelson, yes. That's right.
The playwright. So what are some of the conversations then that you think this play is inviting today's audience to have?
Well, I think one of the things that it concerns is the death penalty.
Okay.
And it's inviting the question as to what is to be done with someone who is deemed beyond rehabilitation. What is the humane thing to do for a functioning society? And I think the way that the play works is that the audience shifts in their agreement. They agree with one version of it, and then the other version of it is equally plausible and accessible. So it's quite a kind of roller coaster in terms of the way that it works as a theatrical event.
Okay, so the themes basically are like justice, punishment, humanity, yes. Human life, that sort of thing. So do you feel...
But the humanity comes from, there is a prisoner, a female, and the question is she, because of her heinous crimes, which I won't go into right now, mm-hmm. but is she worthy of the death penalty? And basically, there is that argument, but the death penalty in this society has been made completely painless and efficient. In other words, it's not like lethal injection, right. or the gas chamber, anything like that. So therefore, if we take away that sense of pain from the death penalty as punishment, but as protection for the larger society, that is part of what the debate is. And so that's, if you like, where the humanity comes in.
The first time I encountered the play was a reading, and I think I was reading The Analyst, Mark. I think that was the part I was reading at that point.
I was somewhere else. I was in the UK or France.
Yeah, and that's often how things happen. You sort of begin with a piece and then it evolves over time. So yeah, now in this incarnation, I'm playing the lawyer and it's a different experience. It's a very interesting experience. So the dynamic is very different.
Sure, sure. So your role, I mean, it's a very pivotal role within the show itself.
Important role. It's all about this lawyer.
Okay. So give us a little bit about who she is, Elizabeth, without giving too much away, obviously, the direction of the show.
Sure. I think who she is who we are. I think she is the connective tissue to the viewer, the audience. I think I sort of goes forth into this world and I'm sort of the canary in the coal mine. In many ways, to bring back messages from the future and from the time that we're in right now. Actually, every day that passes, this play feels more current and immediate and less future-based.
So do you feel it's really reflecting some of the challenges where our society is going through?
Absolutely is. For better or for worse, it really is speaking to the moment. I mean, shockingly, on a daily basis. And I think this play is very helpful, or at least aspires to be. That's what we're trying to do. And I think we succeed to a certain extent. And I think it's sort of a roadmap and a helpful hand to what we're walking through right now.
And what Elizabeth says, which is fascinating, is that one of the questions that it raises is, what is the greater good? And we have so many varying definitions of that floating around right now, today.
Mm-hmm.
And so it puts all those questions about ethics, morality, humanity, death, those are all up, those are all in the hopper of this play, and they ricochet around like a pinball in our present.
So given those themes, how do you see today's audiences, because I know you've already been in previews.
I've done four previews so far, and then we're going to pick up again with previews on Wednesday. Right. Well, they've been incredibly attentive. I mean, I was quite surprised because it is a wordy play.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is. But in the way that those great plays of kind of debates and which are issue plays, but they're under with a kind of underlying emotional fabric, they're really on the edge of their seats paying attention and I can feel them being swayed by this argument or that argument as the thing goes along. So for the audience, they've got a kind of, they themselves have a task, which is to decipher what the kind of the world is that they are living within.
Okay.
So there's a kind of added tussle or an added kind of sense of engagement with the audience, both intellectually and emotionally. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't shy away from making things challenging for an audience intellectually. It's quite abrasive from that point of view. So that sometimes we'll have an audience who are very attuned to the bleak humor within the piece, and then others who are very serious as an audience. And certainly on the first preview, there was a laugh on a particular line. I thought I would never have predicted that, never in a million years. And then I went. Then the next preview, crickets, as they say. So right now, I think we're in the process of discovering that side of it, as well as their focus and intelligence.
Mark has a great skill at creating a team, and that's something that is foundational for doing theater, and also something that really is not understood by a lot of directors. It's so important that you make a team and that everyone pulls together, and because of that, we are now a very happy company. Everyone gets on very well. And believe me, I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true.
And it's important in a show like this, too. I mean, it sounds like a very much like an ensemble piece in that everybody needs to be on the same page.
It really is crucial for me in terms of the way that people can feel free, particularly to fail and to kind of mess it up, you know, because out of that struggle comes really gritty and interesting work, which resonates across into the audience.
But one thing that's very interesting, being a theater maker in New York for many decades, this audience at La Mama has been so diverse, which is rare and exciting. Like, there are people of all ages showing up to this show. And so I am very excited because there's no feeling of like it's this group of people that I'm talking to every night, which is often the case at a lot of theaters. I have no idea who's going to be in this crowd. And that's very interesting to me. And I think really helpful for this play. Mm-hmm. I think it's great.
Yes, me too. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a real cross-section of society rather than an elite who will come in and watch the show. And so, and I think that is important because to a certain extent, the play itself is dealing with a kind of cross-sectional idea.
What do you hope audiences are going to carry away after experiencing this play?
Well, I suppose I hope that they will be stimulated and excited and unsettled by the issues that it raises. And I hope that they'll be moved by the predicaments that they witness. And it'll continue to kind of resonate for days, weeks, however long after they've seen the event. That's probably my great hope for it.
Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth, same question.
Really, the reason why I do live theater is to create group catharsis and to get people to move away from their devices and turn towards each other, that it will also generate conversation between people and between different kinds of people from different perspectives, and they will exchange ideas.
We've been speaking with Mark Wing Davey and Elizabeth Marvel, both of this new production over at La Mama. That play, And Then We Were No More, runs from the 28th of September through and including November 2nd at La Mama Experimental Theater. La Mama is located in Lower Manhattan, 66 East 4th Street. You can get tickets by going to La Mama's website at lamama.org.
And thanks to Tom Candela for that curtain call preview. The full episode is at wjffradio.org. Just enough time to, well, pat ourselves on the back a little bit. I just wanted to make sure that you guys knew that our editorial team drove to Binghamton yesterday through the rainstorm to attend the New York State Broadcasting Association's Excellence in Broadcasting Awards. And I'm so proud to share that Radio Catskill brought home 5 awards this year. Outstanding Public Affairs Program or Series, that's the local edition, Jason Dole and Patricio Rubio producers. Outstanding Spot News, that's Patricio Rubio's report on correctional officers on strike over unsafe conditions. Outstanding Interview, that's Kimberly Izar's report on some NYSEG customers taking drastic measures to lower their bills. Outstanding Election Coverage for Election Night 2024, Patricio Rubio and Jason Dole producers. And a Serving New York Award for our One Small Step campaign that was produced by Isabel Braverman, Judy Balaban, and Ronald Kelson. I've been telling you that we have been defunded, but we're not defeated. That's so true, and this is so evident. That's evidence of that. We're making a strong commitment to the community by continuing to deliver local news and stories that matter. So congratulations to the team. So proud of them. And thank you for supporting independent journalism in the Catskills and beyond. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming. Also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, writer and podcaster Ezra Klein. Politics is about power. And I think people have missed this. Politics is not about self-expression. Politics is about building coalitions capable of winning power and making the decisions you need to do that.
That's Ezra Klein, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, Evie McGee Colbert comes by to talk about the family food she and her husband, Stephen Colbert, cook. And we get into the stories of food on tour with indie musicians. Celebrities, they're just like us. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. A brief shower or two today, otherwise cloudy and a high of 72. Tomorrow, sunshine giving away to some clouds and a high of 72. And we have a little bit of a warm streak starting on Sunday. 78 for a high, partly sunny and very warm. 75 Monday, sunny, pleasant, 75 on Tuesday. But then temperatures drop to more seasonable levels on Wednesday, high 58. On Points coming up in about a minute.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at catskillspropertycare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. Calicoontheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.